So hello and welcome to Horse Race Politics. I'm Dr. Matthew Wall. I'm a political scientist at Swansea University, and I'm joined by my colleagues.
Hi, I'm Dr. Elena Kilby, and I'm a lecturer in journalism.
And I'm Dr. Richard Thomas. I'm senior lecturer in journalism at Swansea's Department of Media and Communication.
Okay, so we're all three of us academics who specialise in the study of campaigns and political communication.
And we've created this podcast to share our analysis of the 2020 US presidential election campaign in real time as it unfolds, using information from political gambling markets to keep score.
So as usual, the podcast will drop each Friday running into the vote. It'll bring you up to speed with the state of the race, and it'll help you to filter out the noise of the campaign, focusing on the stories, the trends, and the moments that really matter.
So this week, with the dust still settling around an almighty October surprise given to us by Donald Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis, hospitalization, and miraculous return to the White House, we want to focus in on polling, looking at how and why we use polls during campaign, and what the latest polls just in, with fieldwork done since this diagnosis, are telling us about the vote in November, as well as talking a little bit about where gambling markets fit into the picture. We're then going to round up this week's stories and campaign developments, including a profile of an heroic fly who managed to dominate reaction to the vice presidential debate. Okay, so let's start off with polls. I wonder, Richard, if you could tell us a little bit about where polls fit in, I suppose, in the dynamics and our understanding of campaigns and how people have used them and in some cases criticised them.
Well, I suppose at the most basic level, Matt, they're essentially a measure of public opinion, aren't they? Many people feel that they're the best and most scientific way to represent that in a way that perhaps smaller samples of vox pops don't do. Jimmy Carter, former president, had his own sort of idea about measures of popularity. He used to say that the best gauge of what the public thought of you was, excluding thumbs, how many fingers people used when they waved at you. Anything less than three and you were probably in trouble. So polls became widely used in the 80s. By the time of the last presidential campaign, research suggests there were over 1,000 polls taken during the campaign. They're widespread in the UK, and of course the internet has only sort of accelerated their use, and we're all used to answering questions now online anyway. So I suppose polling taps into our usual sorts of online behavior. And more polls, of course, mean more coverage. So most polls are really interested in who's going to win and who we intend to vote for. These seem to be the headline grabbers more than polls that ask citizens what they feel about a particular issue. Elena and I actually both involved in research back in 2015 UK general election, and that our data sort of showed that quite starkly. Horse race polls, much more popular with the media. So the first thing to say about polls, they're of interest to politicians. So, for example, before the VP debate last night, Harris knew that she needed to perhaps play it safe. Pence knew, according to the opinion polls, that he probably had to do something a little bit more special. But whether they actually did that, we'll come on to that a little bit later. Noam Chomsky has had something to say about polls in the past. And he said that they're there primarily for party machines to know how to design the future propaganda. Mm-hmm. And that's very much reflects the sort of general critique of polls. Professor Justin Lewis from Cardiff wrote a really good paper about all this about 20 years ago called The Opinion Poll as a Cultural Form. And he makes the point that things like wording or the briefing given by interviewers has a significant impact on skewing the results. But he also talks about this spiral of imperfect circle where a distant public comment upon a discursive world shaped by the remorseless repackaging and representation of itself. So it's the poll begets a poll begets a poll. Mm. Perhaps in a less scholarly way, though, the polls reflect something about the impatience of modern life, don't they? We can't wait for Christmas Day. We've got to know what we're getting from Santa beforehand. J.B. Priestley had a really good analogy here. He said, the best way to think about polls is that they're like children in a garden, constantly digging things up to see how they're growing.
Nice.
So if we want to be a bit more scientific, for news consumers, the race is part of something bigger than politics. we have these things called news values. You know, polls fuel the news values, don't they? Mm-hmm. They're about conflict, famous people, planned events, press conferences, all of that. So in terms of the sort of journalism scholarship part of all this, they tick a lot more boxes, polls do, than stories about education or healthcare or things like that. So they also tap into our love of sport as well, don't we? Who's mm-hmm. going to win? Our podcast is called Horse Race Politics. Polling also generates some star names, doesn't it? In the US, you've got Nate Silver. Here we've got Professor Sir John Curtis from Strathclyde, who must be as busy as any UK journalist around election time. And in the UK, we've got some bitter past experience, haven't we, of polls. Both the last two elections, 2017 and 2019, the polls leading up to the elections, you know, got it quite dramatically wrong. 2017, a clear Tory majority was predicted. We ended up with a hung parliament in 2019. The Tory majority was estimated to be somewhere between 30 and 50. And of course, it was 86. So for what they're worth, that's a moot point. But I think in conclusion, I would say some people say they have no value since they only reflect the opinions of people who weren't clever enough to jump into a shop doorway when they saw someone walking towards them with a clipboard.
Yeah, I mean, it just picking up on the last thing you said, Richard, I mean, the really big first polling failure in the UK recent years was 2015, actually, mm-hmm. When I think out of, say, 100 polls, something like 99 predicted a hung parliament. And obviously we got David Cameron's Tory majority, which led to the Brexit referendum, which was also mispolled. And actually 2019, while, yeah, you're right, it underpredicted the Conservative seat majority, it wasn't far out in terms of vote share. Britain has a pretty capricious electoral system, very like America. And so sometimes it can, small margins can mean big differences in terms of seats or electoral college votes, you know.
I think what was interesting as well in both 2017 and 2019 is that exit polls were actually quite accurate, weren't they? They got it spot on, which tells you something about when people have voted. You know, they're perhaps a bit more prepared to tell the truth than before they vote. I mean, that's an interesting discussion as well.
You're also asking them about what they did rather than what they intend to do.
Yeah.
It's not just truthfulness. I think it's different recalling something than estimating what you're going to do.
I've only been asked a couple of times in my voting career in an exit poll what I voted, and I refused to tell them on the basis it's a secret ballot and I'm not telling mm-hmm. them what my vote was.
I'm sure they were delighted with that.
They were chuffed, yeah.
If I could move on to yourself, Elena, because as I was saying in the introduction, we've had some time now for polling to come through where the field work has taken place after Donald Trump's COVID diagnosis and all the drama that surrounded it. And so, yeah, I wonder, could you tell us what some of the developments have been in the polling since then?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I kind of went over this last night because obviously this thing is changing constantly, as we've seen over the last couple of days, as stories are coming in thick and fast. But Biden is currently ahead of Trump in numerous polls that have been collated by Real Clear Politics. So The Economist, CNN, NBC, New York Times, The Hill. Biden is hovering around an average 9-point lead. So I think that's 51% to Trump's 42. But I think we have to be clear that this doesn't guarantee Biden a victory. As we saw with Hillary Clinton in 2016, she also had a clear lead over Trump in the polls. But she actually ended up losing the Electoral College. Now, because the presidential voting system assigns each state a number of electoral college votes, a handful of swing states will probably get to decide the election. So I think that's what Biden is counting on at the moment. And to be quite honest, he's doing pretty well in quite a number of these swing states, even those that Trump won in 2016. So in Wisconsin, Biden has a 5-point lead. And in Florida, I think it was the Quinnipiac poll gives Biden an 11-point lead in the polls. So why is he ahead? I think this is probably the main question we're all asking at the moment. And I think we possibly know the answer to this, but I think there's a bit more to it. So if we consider how Biden is and maybe his temperament, I mean, he's not as strident as what Trump is. So people might find this reassuring who maybe have become quite sick and tired of this visceral political atmosphere in the US. But I think maybe the go-to reason is just down to COVID. I think it was a poll that was conducted by Monmouth University in the last few days, and their chief reason given by the general public was Biden's lead was due to the fact that more voters put their trust in Biden on handling COVID, which isn't probably that surprising given what we've seen over the last week in terms of the administration's lack of, you know, their disregard for COVID safety and also Trump's theatrical photo ops that have been used to make him look strong and very much presidential. But yeah. I mean, as I say, I mean, we do have to take polls with a pinch of salt to a certain degree. And Richard has also mentioned this. One thing that I noticed yesterday was two of the kind of leading polls for Pennsylvania, which is another swing state in the election, mm-hmm. is the Emerson poll put Biden leading by 5 points, but Quinnipiac had Biden leading by 13 points. So there's a kind of massive margin there. And I think this gives us some indication of why that we shouldn't put our absolute trust in polls to try and predict the winner of the election. And one of the reasons yourself and Richard just hit upon as well, and when Richard mentioned Justin Lewis's research, is how are these questions put together? So what type of questions are they? How many people were interviewed? Were there more people in one poll than the other? What time of day was it? When did the survey happen? All of these things can affect the outcome of polling data. There's also the issue of margin of error. You know, we can't get a completely true result if you're only speaking with a small section of the population. But I think most importantly is because polling just keeps happening. So we have to remember that it's just purely a snapshot in time about what the public is thinking and feeling at a particular moment in time when that particular polling company is collecting the data. But I think we have to remember that people do change their minds and they can do so quite quickly. Now, if we think back to this week 4 years ago, the story broke about Trump mm-hmm. being caught on tape talking to Access Hollywood host Billy Bush about his habit of sexually assaulting women. Now, at that time, this appeared completely catastrophic for Trump's campaign. A number of Republican senators and governors, House members withdrew their support for his candidacy. And it also secured a lead for Hillary from, I think it was 4.6 to 7.1 within the 10 days of the tape being released. But then we have another surprise that happened, as we call the October surprise, where this began to drop off as the Podesta email story came out and the Comey investigation into Clinton's emails started to gain traction. So I think what mm-hmm. I'm trying to say is it's all to play for and it's still early days, even though it doesn't seem that it's that long away, we could still be in for some other October surprises that could impact the polling results.
I think important to also bear in mind, though, is that the polls can be wrong in either direction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, if you go back to the UK with what happened in 2017, in polling, you have to sort of do weighting for people who don't respond, but you also have to try and figure out who the hell's actually going to vote, right?
Yeah.
So you're trying to adjust the data. And sort of what happened in the UK was, well, there was a big underestimate of the Conservatives, right, in 2015, mm-hmm. and they got their majority and everyone was annoyed. So the pollsters adjusted, I suppose, to give more weight to, you know, shy Tories or, you know, Tory voters. Well, what happened in 2017? Of course, they underestimated Labour and there was a hung parliament mm-hmm. when everyone expected a Conservative majority. And so, you know, I think it's important to bear in mind that the US polling industry hasn't been static in terms of how it does this stuff from 2016 to today. And just as there's a chance that Donald Trump might be underestimated, there's also a chance that he might be overestimated, you know, because it's not like a straightforward, there is just one way to get a polling outcome. There's a lot of adjustment, sort of technical stuff. And, you know, what's been really interesting is we've been hearing more and more about sort of shy Trump voters, people who are basically unwilling to say that they'll vote for Donald Trump. And to the point where I think there's nearly a kind of a anti-polling sentiment, right, among mm-hmm. Trump supporters, that polls themselves are part of the fake news. So, you know, it is very difficult, but I do see Biden as being in a kind of structurally stronger position on the polling than Hillary was. And while you're totally right, Elena, to say that with this type of volatile campaign, anything can happen, At the same time, every day that ticks down without something happening, and we'll talk about the VP debate, I think being another moment that passed without a massive shift.
Yeah.
The weight, I suppose, of the advantage becomes greater. And so, you know, we're seeing that obviously in the betting. But it's, what's really interesting is you talked about Nate Silver, I think, Richard, as one of these superstars, or was it yourself, Elena? But like, so Nate Silver has Donald Trump at something like 83%, has Joe Biden at something like 83% likely to win through all his projections. And that factors in polling uncertainty. It factors in the Electoral College. But in the betting is a lot more cautious, you know, so it's about sort of Biden at 65-66%. And so, you know, I think that's I think the betting is going along a little bit with your logic, Elena, to say, well, there's a lot of room for surprises here. Whereas people like Nate Silver and 538.com are doing a more straightforward, well, what normally happens with polling at this stage is we'd expect Biden to win. And especially, Elena, as you said, if you look at Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan in particular, Biden is pretty comfortable in all three. Florida, it's a bit more up and down, like the recent polling has been better. But like, it's very hard for Trump to win without looking at those kind of Rust Belt states coming to his aid again. And so I do tend to see it as the polling is definitely to be taken with a pinch of salt, for sure. And I think the betting markets are, in a sense, giving us a kind of a number on that. About a 20% pinch of salt. Like in pure polling terms, Trump's campaign is in real trouble. And with all of this craziness that we've had in the last week, the big picture of that is more or less, it seems to me, about a 2-point shift in Biden's favor. And I think there are those 4 million people that you talked about, Richard, last week, the floating voters. Some of them have been persuaded, I think. Now, whether that sustains, it's a really valid question. And whether something happens that changes it. But for the moment, we talked about how Trump needed to shift momentum. The momentum shift has been in Biden's favor to the extent that it's measured.
I think in some ways we can sort of look at things from here on in terms of risk. You know, we talk to students about risk and the risk society. I mean, if we're looking at the way the campaigns are running, we've got one campaign that need to take no risks, and we've got another campaign that have to take risks in order just to make some ground up. And I don't think that's something that's going to scare Donald Trump. He's used to taking risks. He's used to doing things that are unconventional. But what can he put out of the bag that's going to start narrowing that gap? Who knows?
Yeah, and it connects to what you guys were saying earlier about how are polls used. They're used to inform campaign strategy. So if I'm a campaign strategist looking at these polling numbers, I'd be advising the Biden campaign to basically say nothing and keep a sort of, you know, basically just make no risk strategy. And you saw it, with Kamala Harris, but also Biden in the debate, you know, they're not putting much forward in terms of, for example, packing the Supreme Court. What are they going to do about that? They're not focusing very heavily on their policy agenda. I think they're running on just being not Donald Trump. Yeah. And, I think that's, looking at that polling figures, that doesn't leave a lot of hostages to fortune, you know?
I think if it was a football team, they'd just want to park the bus now in front of the goal, wouldn't they? You know?
Yeah, Jose Mourinho style. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. So with that sort of said, it is interesting to look at, I suppose, how the media, both sort of mainstream and social and satirical and so on, has been processing this kind of cavalcade of campaign news in since we last recorded, so in the last week or so, because it's one of those, you know, I think as Marx said, sometimes nothing happens for decades and then decades happen in weeks, you know?
Yeah.
And it feels like a long time ago when we recorded our last podcast. So yeah, I wonder, Richard, you've been kind of trying to put together sort of a digest, I suppose, of mainstream media coverage.
I'm going to take a huge gulp of breath because I'm going to try and attempt to read out some headlines. Right, here we go. Are you ready?
Ready.
Poll shows Trump 14 points behind Biden. Trump releases first video message from hospital room. Consultant linked to Trump tied to Facebook pages warning elections will cause civil war. Trump downplays COVID dangers after removing mask. Trump's drive-by visit dubbed insanity. Melania Trump discusses Stormy Daniels and secretly recorded tapes. Trump told Woodward he didn't have a lot of time to meet Fauci as virus spread. Mary Trump says president sees illness as a sign of unforgivable weakness. Next debate should be cancelled if president's still sick, says Biden. Trump aide Stephen Miller tests positive. Ebola doctor Trump vilified in 2014 hits out a president for lack of empathy. Fear, division and chaos, says Michelle Obama. Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani coughs his way through anti-mask interview. Twitter removes campaign video of Trump scoring touchdown against COVID-19. US military chiefs in quarantine as COVID spreads. Andrew Cuomo brains Donald Trump for worst failure since Pearl Harbor. Markets fret as Trump pulls plug on stimulus package talks. That's 3 days worth of news.
It just felt like you were just shouting at us there, Rich.
It was. I was doing it in the style of American broadcast. It was 3 days worth of news. And it just feels that that is five campaigns worth of events. And it all happened. Most of it was bad news for Trump. And it all happened in a few days. So talk about fast moving. I do sense, and we were talking about this earlier, Matt, weren't we? We do sense that some of the stuffing has been knocked out of, if not Trump, certainly the way that Fox News were representing it. Mm. There was an interesting analogy or a connection made with Boris Johnson, and it made the point that catching coronavirus had sort of knocked the stuffing out of Boris Johnson. And a number of people were saying, you know, was this going to do the same to Donald Trump? Was it just going to kind of leave him with low resources of energy and so on? We even found that despite Sean Hannity of Fox still banging the drum, saying, you know, connecting Trump to Roosevelt and Churchill and all this kind of stuff, I do get the sense that Fox have sort of had the wind taken out of their sails a bit. Their reporting about the whole coronavirus thing was playing down the president's problems, but it was going very much with official narratives from doctors and so on. It wasn't adding their own commentary. There was no sort of challenge, but there was no cheerleading either. It was quite bland kind of reporting. So I think if we are going to take Fox as a sort of, you know, an indicator of the biggest cheerleaders for Trump, we can say that they seem to just lose a bit of enthusiasm over the last week. I don't know if you sense the same there, Matt.
Yeah, well, it's a funny one because for me, it's like the way that the progress of the disease seems to have gone is the best possible way it could have gone for Donald Trump, right? You know, picture an alternative scenario where he's incommunicado in a hospital bed in the military hospital. You know, he seems to me to be in a sort of a hyperactive frenzy. I don't know whether that's to do with the steroids that he's on. But in terms of how when it was announced he was going to the hospital, this is nearly the best way it could have turned out for his whole alpha identity that we talked about, Elena, last week. But nonetheless, yeah, you do sense with Fox in particular a toning down, let's say.
A resignation as well, almost, you know, resigned to what's likely to happen now, yeah.
Yeah, but and no matter what, nearly no matter what frame, in terms of the agenda, it's been nothing but wall-to-wall COVID, right? Mm, so, yeah, yeah. You know, one of the tweets I saw was that there were more cases of COVID in the White House than in the whole of New Zealand.
Yeah,
correct.
You know, and so it's just this rolling story of one person after another testing positive. It's the reconstruction of the Rose Garden event that seems to be at the epicenter of the outbreak. It's and we talked about right at the start how coronavirus is this poisonous issue for the Trump campaign. And the whole media narrative about what is this about has been stuck on COVID now.
There was a section on CNN, actually, where they showed sort of yearbook style the photographs of people who Trump had been into contact with around the time of his diagnosis. And they were sort of moving them back and forth into columns, you know, positive, negative, awaiting test results. And they were sort of shifting positions, you know, just to sort of track the way the virus was finding its way around the inner sanctum of his advisors and so on.
Yeah, it's made Donald Trump and COVID completely contiguous, I think, in the public imagination in a way that few things really could have. One thing I wanted to focus on a couple of those stories, though, one of which is the relief package. And like that seemed to me, I was looking at it as a sort of campaigns guy and going, what are you doing? I mean, here's a chance to give out free money in essentially a month before an election. Yeah. And you're saying no.
Yeah.
I mean, give out the money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it just from a campaign strategy perspective. Yeah.
Show them the money. Weird. Show them the money. Yeah, make a lot of sense.
Literally sending people a check. You know, it's kind of old school, right? Back in like, you know, the 19th century, rotten boroughs and all this stuff in England. So people would buy drinks they'd treat the voters. Seemed to me an easy win.
It does make you wonder, you know, to what degree does the president actually listen to those advisors around him who must have been telling him that, Matt, you know? How open is he to taking advice off other people? It's been an ongoing theme throughout his presidency, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, and I suppose there's a sort of sense of not bowing to Nancy Pelosi and you know, the Democrats on the House of Representatives. But my God, I mean, well, if you're so far behind and you have a chance to send literally checks to the entire electorate, and you're like, no.
Yeah,
it just didn't. I literally didn't understand why that's not happening. From a campaign strategy perspective. The other thing I suppose I wanted to talk about, and Elena, it's been another meme producer is the vice presidential debate. For me, you know, it was much more standard fare in terms of tone and but again, you know. It's hard to get away from COVID when there's two plexiglass screens continuously separating you, right? It's kind of a visual reminder. But yeah, I mean, for me, the star was the fly.
Yeah, Lord of the Flies right there. I mean, it's gained so much traction, but also these kind of gifts around Kamala as well. That's just kind of exploded and gone viral in the last couple of hours, these kind of expression gifts of, you know, her reactions to what Mike Pence was saying as well. And that seems to be like a big story on social media too, as well as Lord of the Flies.
And for a fly that was only on the screen or on his head for 2 minutes, it's become immortal, because I was watching the debate following Twitter. Someone created a Twitter account for Mike Pence's fly. by the end of the debate, it had 30,000 followers. I checked a little bit earlier and it was almost 100,000 followers. That's how popular the fly was.
Yeah. I've been trying to get over, you might remember, a hit from the 90s, Pretty Fly for a White Guy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It hasn't landed in the cyber sphere. But yeah, it's funny. I saw as well, I don't know, did you see Elena James Corden recreated the Beatles, Maybe I'm Afraid, Maybe I'm Amazed. It's a lovely song, actually, with a kind of a Trump specialized lyrics. He's playing the kind of grand piano.
No, I haven't
caught
that
one. Was that one that came across your bows?
No, I'll have to check that one. I mean, what I've been trying to do this week is trying to have like more of a varied look. And I think one of the things I've experienced since Trump's diagnosis is the memes have kind of exploded all over my social media. And it's, again, COVID being the main event. So pictures of Trump being fed Clorox through a drip, drinking bleach from a bottle. Even the Biden-Obama memes made a comeback this week, with Biden asking if he could write stay positive and a get well card to Donald Trump. So I think there's been a lot more of that this week. And I think what we have to remember, is especially with memes, what we've seen now with Pence and Kamala, is that they're a really important mode of communication, and especially during the 2016 election. So I think the spreading of these messages on social media, even though that they might just be seen as a joke, that, you know, they might not be as sophisticated as some of the arguments that, you know, somebody like John Oliver puts across, but there is a real message behind them, which in this case is skewering Trump's shambolic handling of COVID.
And what's interesting, I mean, one that I saw was really good was, you know, when Trump is kind of stumbling up the stairs and he puts the face mask in his pocket, you know, quite like assertively. But they kind of mixed over Don't Cry For Me, Argentina.
Yeah,
you know,
a really rubbish Evita.
But what's crazy is how those memes, they sort of reshape actual campaign materials in your mind to where what you actually recall is the parody rather than the original. You know, and that kind of remixing, I suppose, of campaign material is increasingly a feature, I think, of modern political communication.
Yeah, and it's like you mentioned in the first podcast that we did with Tina Fey and with Sarah Palin. I mean, they're just completely interchangeable now, and we always think of Tina Fey as being Sarah Palin. So it's actually quite powerful. But going back to some of the other kind of niche satire approaches this week, I mean, they pretty much hit on what some of the memes have done. So this big message being that across all of these TV satire programs, that the absolute lack of surprise that Trump contracted the virus when he and his administration had not taken the virus seriously at all. So you had the likes of Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers and Trevor Noah all made reference to these kind of big rallies that Trump has been holding over the last few months. The Rose Garden confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. So that being this kind of super spreader event, essentially. Yeah. And also the mocking of Biden for wearing a mask. I mean, it's just embarrassing just how quickly that's come back to haunt him, really. But I think what all of these hosts have kind of been keen to point out is that Trump has really learned nothing from contracting the virus. And I think that this is the problem about strategy that you were talking earlier, is that this would have been a fantastic opportunity for Trump to turn this around. As you mentioned about taking risks earlier, Richard, if he contracted the virus, show compassion to the American public, that he knows what it's like and he's going to turn this around. All he's pretty much done is just double down on this tough guy approach and continuing to blatantly disregard the seriousness of the virus.
Well, everyone, as far as I can tell from the rhetoric, everyone who's died of it is a wimp, you know, who's let it dominate them. And with 210 plus thousand deaths, that's a lot of people to be alienating. So yeah, listen, we'd better wrap it up because we're running out of time. But we can say, like, at the end of the week, the polls And the odds are showing this campaign trending towards Biden, but in such a chaotic environment, I suppose, as Elena said, there's pretty much a lot left to play for, and so hopefully we'll be able to catch you up on how that's developed next week. So yeah, I would just like to thank our guests, so Richard and Elena, and just to note that the funding for this podcast comes from the Cherish Digital Economy Centre at Swansea University. And we'll all see you next week. And thank you very much.